Hi everyone, Data Stories number 30. Hi Moritz, how are you?
Hey Enrico, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Wow, yeah. Number 30, it's a nice number. I like it.
It's almost like an anniversary.
Yeah, it is.
We're growing up, man. Slowly. Yeah.
Actually, I'm
not so fit. I have the flu. I have the kindergarten flu, which is one of the diseases nobody really talks about, but it's a killer.
Yeah, it's the toughest one, actually.
Yeah, 6 months of agony ahead.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
it's terrible.
Yeah, so I'm high on ginger tea and let's see what happens next.
Yeah. I had the same last week. Yeah. It's just an ongoing process. Yeah. So what's going on? Any news from your side?
Not so much. Just wrapping up the year, super busy with all the open ends that I said I will take care of later.
Yeah.
I just published that B graphic.
Yeah, I really like that one. Yeah.
So it's for Scientific American on the, there was a really interesting study on the development of wild bees, and it turned out a lot of them, at least in the area they investigated, had gone locally extinct, and but also others had built up new relationships with plants. So it was kind of an interesting data set. And I sort of documented that also on my blog. So if you're interested, you can read that.
Yeah,
and I liked how it turned out. It's, for me, it's not home turf to work on an A4 page, but it sort of worked out, I think.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Working hard as usual, and looking forward to having some vacation.
Sure.
Nothing really special. I keep working with my students, and they presented previews of their projects in the class I'm teaching, and I have to say that there are some interesting projects. I hope I will be able to show some stuff on the web once they are done.
What's the topic or a theme? Do you know? Did you?
Well, every student does a different project. There are people who are doing more things on the data analysis side, so they're just using analytics and visualization tools to discover something in a data set they are interested in. So, for instance, there is one guy who is actually using a data set coming from his own company, so which makes things quite interesting. I have a couple of groups actually doing that.
Nice.
There is one on the financial market and another one on the... what's this company about? I think they are running certification tests, and they have a huge database of the results of this test, and is interested in discovering something out there. But I also have students doing more creative stuff. There is one student who is creating a sort of tabletop version of multidimensional projections, and then you can interact with this stuff with your hands. It's quite nice. There is a whole range of different stuff.
Cool.
It's fun.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, we have a guest today, as usual. And I'm really happy to introduce Marion Dork. And we are going to talk about something really special and somewhat sounds a bit weird. The title of the show today, it's The Information Flaneur, which Marion will explain shortly what is about. And hi, Marion. How are you?
Hi, Enrico. I'm fine. I'm happy to be on your show.
It's great to have you on the show. So, Marian is a... I think you are a newly appointed professor, right? Recently appointed in Potsdam, close to Berlin, right? Or in Berlin. I don't remember exactly.
It's just outside of Berlin. I'm living in Berlin, but I'm working in Potsdam. Actually, at the... so, it's called in English. It's probably called the University of Applied Sciences of Potsdam.
Yeah,
and actually, this is the place where Moritz has his master from.
That's right.
Wow! Connections everywhere.
So the Potsdam connection is it's everywhere. It's like the kindergarten flu, really.
It spreads.
No, but we were joking, really, at this Visualized Berlin conference. I think everybody except two people had some connection to Potsdam, like taught there, has been studying there or something. So,
yeah. So I have to say I'm really happy to have you on the show, Marian. And I think both me and Moritz, we are fan of your work, and I always cross you in some conferences or other events, and it's always fun to see your work and talk to you. So I think the best way to start is if you give a little bit of background, what you do, what you've done in the past, and finally introduce the idea of information flaneur, which is really, really interesting.
Sure. Interesting and weird, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. Okay, well, weird things are interesting, right, by definition.
That's true. That's true. I'm actually really happy to be on the show because I've been listening in and out. I haven't caught up with every show, but I have to say, coming after Ben Schneiderman is, you know, it's really tough. So that last show I actually really enjoyed. So a little bit about myself. I actually started a university in my hometown at the University of Magdeburg in Germany, where I studied computational visualistics.
Like Gregor Eich,
by the
way.
As Gregor, right?
Yeah, the connections are... It's getting
and
worse and worse.
Gregor, also Petra, who you had on the show a couple of weeks back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a computer science degree, but with a focus on graphics, visualization, image processing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and also some sort of non-technical subjects. So we had some politics and psychology and design. So it's a really neat program. Anyways, I did actually my final thesis project for my for this degree. I actually already did at the University of Calgary as a sort of diplome intern with Sheila Carpendale and Carrie Williamson. And this project sort of got me hooked into sort of visualization and information seeking. So sort of visual search as sort of a label, which at the beginning I didn't really like, but now I think it sort of fits for what I'm doing. And this project, I really enjoyed. It was sort of dynamic queries for blogs on the web, the idea of juxtaposing different simple visualizations of maybe time, map, or location and tags, and using that to explore or filter through blog posts and other stuff. Anyway, so during that time, I actually noticed that information visualization is not just a tool for, not just a useful tool for data analysis, but also really for sort of this open-ended information seeking, sort of moving around in large, complex information spaces. And I actually stayed or came back to Calgary for doing a PhD with Sheila Carpendale and Carrie Williamson. And during that time, I was sort of going really deep into that subject. I did a few case studies. I also did some internships at industry labs where we sort of dealt with Twitter data, with academic publications, and sort of rich collections where essentially the data is not just data, but it has these rich, complex links among it. And it sort of invites... not just for analysis, but actually also for sort of navigation and looking around. I finished that PhD a little bit over a year ago, 1.5 years ago. And then I went to Newcastle University in the UK, where I did a 1-year postdoc working on the Patina project, where we sort of tried to develop visual interfaces for archives and for playful text analysis. And fairly freshly, I'm now in Berlin since October, working at the University of Applied Sciences in Potsdam. I'm really happy to be there. Both students and staff are super friendly and interested. And actually, I have a sort of funny position. It's called a research professorships. Mm-hmm. A professorship. So that means that I have, compared to other sort of polytechnic-like universities, mm-hmm. Which in Germany are called Fachhochschulen, yeah. I have a reduced teaching load, and I'm sort of expected and or I'm allowed to do lots of research. So I'm trying to
<Sounds awesome. laughs>
Yeah, it's actually quite nice. And I'm sort of trying to bring research.
You are allowed to do research. Sounds nice.
In your spare time, of course.
In your spare time.
No, actually, yeah, well, also because you don't stop, but you don't stop thinking. But I'm actually co-teaching right now a course with Sebastian Meyer, and we really try to do that to bring research questions into this course, and not just hinge on the sort of fundamentals, but actually outline where open questions are and where we can sort of push the boundaries. Even though these students, they're not PhD students yet; they're like bachelor students and master students, not in the first years, but they're really keen on doing something novel and something useful, and it's good fun.
So, Marianne, so you briefly mentioned that at some point in your research you came up with this idea that there is something beyond data analysis, and then visualization may play a big role there. And I think that's the main topic of this show and of this episode, sorry. And that's the reason why we wanted to talk with you, because I think it's really, really interesting, the idea of using visualization for something that is beyond data analysis and beyond having a very specific question to target, but it's more kind of like exploration and just curiosity, right? Supporting curiosity, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess,
yeah. Yeah.
And even mm-hmm. serendipity, discovering something that you didn't expect, or just navigate large spaces to see what's there, right? If I understand it right. And I think this is what you call information. That's the reason why you mentioned information flaneur or something like that. Can you explain to us a little bit better what you mean by information flaneur? What is the flaneur? It's a weird
thing. So I could maybe start with actually why I came across this, because
sure,
it's fairly
sure.
serendipitous. Or so in Calgary during my PhD time, I was also allowed, encouraged to take non-computer science courses, and one of the courses I took was urban design theory, and I came across this.
It was what?
This notion.
Sorry, can you say it again? It was what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was urban design theory.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of city studies or city urban theory, urban studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we read about different design thinking around the city planning, but also sort of from sort of cultural from cultural studies and sort of literature to some degree. And I came across this notion of the flaneur, of the urban wanderer of the 19th century, sort of roaming the streets of Paris. And it's sort of a beautiful picture of a curious fella enjoying the city and being, maybe also being critical. But the thing is, I came across this during an exam, sort of a midway exam, or sort of a time during the PhD where I had to write a report. I had some questions for it, and I was sort of, I wanted to write about something else, not visualization and research questions and blah. So I actually introduced in that paper, I introduced an X course, sort of like a distraction section that was about the flaneur. And I was sort of making that leap that maybe the flaneur, maybe that notion of this curious, strolling guy is actually what visualization can do for rich information spaces. And So for me, that was sort of a way to keep my mind interested in that task of writing that paper. And in the end, and I tried to find linkages. And in the end, my supervisor Sheila Carpendale, she said, "Well, Marianne, actually, this is it. This is what really captures what visualization can do when we search through and explore collections and information spaces." And then I started to sort of revisit this more seriously, and actually there are some really interesting linkages, and I found it to be really fruitful. So now, how so? So in the end, the flaneur gives us a new perspective on the city. So while we might see the city as a place for economy, so for work and for living and for commerce, the flaneur sees the city sort of curiously along different senses, smells, sounds, but is also a sort of critical person who questions. So at the time when the flaneur came up as a sort of cultural figure, industrialization was picking up steam, literally, and capitalism was sort of, bringing up all different kinds of issues, and anonymity, and maybe also poverty, and so forth. So the flaneur is not just a dandy enjoying and being fascinated by the city, but also someone who notices, oh, there's all these other things that are happening that are also problematic. So he develops, by wandering around, by reflecting, by taking in the different perceptions, he develops his own perspective, and also he sort of walks at a different pace that gives him a privileged sensation of the city, and then also is someone, maybe someone poetic, someone creative, also sort of reimagines what city life could be. And I was sort of reading all these different texts, like Walter Benjamin and others, and I thought, wow, that's such a, you know, and I was sort of picking the good bits, you know. There are also issues with this figure we can talk about later. But, and I found this attitude of that flaneur towards the city, towards this new cultural backdrop. You know, back then, 19th century, was this growing cultural backdrop for most of the things that were happening in terms of culture and science and so forth. The flaneur posed an interesting attitude and an interesting perspective. And I think we can borrow that. We can borrow the flaneur's attitude to think about how we engage with digital information. You know, as the web is becoming the sort of the cultural backdrop for everything that we do. You know, if we go to a theater play, or if we go to a conference, or if we just have breakfast, Twitter or some other social media site, whatever, is always with us. Email is with us. We are sharing photos on Instagram and so forth. So the web has become that, I think, that complementary backdrop. Besides the physical urban sphere, there's also the digital sphere. And I think the information flaneur is my attempt to frame the searcher or the viewer or the person, engaging with the digital around positive aspects, around curiosity, around, reflection and creativity. And I try to contrast that sort of optimistic or idealistic persona with the models that we had before in information seeking. So traditionally, the searcher, from what I was sort of comparing the sort of the role of visualization, the searcher was framed around deficiencies, like information needs, knowledge gaps, problems. Actually, a recent paper talked about the pathology, the dark side of information, the pathologies. So, sure, I mean, I think we are all... yeah, anxiety. And, you know, sure, we all, you know, we are all patients, but in a way, but I don't want to design for a patient. I don't want to design medicine. You know, it also has this sort of bitterness to it.
I like this concept.
But I think we can also turn it around. And there's actually evidence that people are enjoying when they encounter more data. You know, genealogists in North America, they're crazy about new data. Once they find a new archive, more dust to go through, they're just excited about it. And there's so many examples of our sort of day-to-day information practices, you know, as we roam bookshops or just scan our environment, where such as serendipity, such as information encountering, right?
Sure.
People actually have positive information experiences. And so the information flaneur became sort of, on the one hand, using the flaneur as a lens. And then it's not just, you know, I'm not just imagining or dreaming up my favorite user persona, but I actually then use evidence from studies about emotion and perception and just also information practices that and bring them together.
So, Marian, I'm wondering, can you give us a couple of examples of visualization tools that you develop that actually goes exactly into this direction? I think this would make more concrete for our listeners what you're saying.
Yeah, so I came up with the concept of the information flaneur, I think after maybe the second PhD project. So sort of post hoc, I could say, yeah, it sort of fits the model, but they weren't really designed towards the information flaneur. The first visualization that actually was explicitly designed for sort of strolling through information spaces was a project I've done at Microsoft Research called Pivot Paths. So it's a visualization slash interface with which you can explore academic publications. And in particular, you can look at authors, publications, and keywords. And everything hinges on the publications, the authors, and also then co-authorship relationships, as well as the keywords associated with these papers. And the interface, essentially, after you've chosen a starting point, which is not really the main point of the tool, after you've chosen maybe an author, you are presented with maybe her most cited 20 papers. And then it actually, the interface arranges. So this is sort of shown horizontally in the middle. And then above and below, you have a sort of visualization that shows the most frequent keywords below. And above, you see all the authors, all the co-authors of this author, of the selected author. And of course, it's, you know, talking about visualization without showing, but let's pretend our listeners actually have it right in front of their eyes right now.
Yeah, we can put it into the post or...
Yeah.
But the point was with this is essentially that we have a visualization. We see, oh, this person is co-authoring a lot with this other person because I adjust the font size and I have a certain arrangement that communicates that. But on top of that, all of these sort of elements, authors, papers, keywords in this arrangement are interactive. So you can actually click on them and they become the new anchor point. Mm-hmm. So you sort of pivot from one...
And that's a pivot element, obviously, is that you always have one pivot point, right?
Exactly, yeah. So
I got it.
Yes, that's the point.
That's nice.
And as you... And so the thing is... So the flaneur, when he moves through the city, there are not really discontinuities. I mean, yes, sometimes something is overlapping, something is behind a building or whatever, but as you take one step forward and another, it's really like a gradual movement. But the way we move on the web, either by changing search queries or by clicking on links, is very abrupt. You know, one display change after another, you don't actually see the overlap between these. And with Pivot Paths, we try to connect these states because as you move from author A to author B, there must be an overlap because author B is already co-author from A. So we can actually pull along the publications and the metadata, like the keywords and the other authors, into the next state. So you have a continuous. So you actually, as you pivot,
it's clear
from
how
to
they
next,
relate to each other. That's
yes,
very nice.
Yeah. And you're sort of perceptually you're dragged along, and your movement through that space is, you could say, a strolling movement. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also, so this tool is also, it's sort of like a weakness of the tool. The tool doesn't really let you filter down or reduce much. You actually can only do that movement. So that's the problem of a research project that has just 3 months. But, we deployed this for a couple of weeks and people had some issue at the beginning because they didn't see the point. They thought it was about, you know, drilling into one, you know, the right result. And then as they used it more, they noticed, oh, it's actually about that movement, about learning about a person's research.
But I mean,
interests.
That's an obvious, I think, like attack vector is that if you say, I mean, I understand you're optimizing for, let's say we take an arbitrary starting point and then the interesting things happen as you move from step to step and you're sort of being inspired by what you see. And also you make your own decisions. So it's kind of this really interesting interplay. But I think the obvious attack vector would be to say, well, what's the big picture? So I collect a lot of anecdotal evidence or I get some feeling for what the city is or what this document collection is. But how will I know it's complete?
Okay. Good question.
Sorry for that.
Oh, what a downer. Enjoying ourselves.
Years of research down the drain.
But so this prototype...
No, you must get that a lot. I mean, you must get that in every single paper session, right?
Yes, I just say next question, please.
Boring.
Okay, so the prototype...
You are ready for an academic career, Moritz.
So this prototype is showing only the top 20, or depending on how big your window is. And I think that was one of the frustrations I had with that project, or we all had, that what do we do, how do we give presence to what you know, to what we can't show. So it's kind of with Google, when we, in a search interface, what do we do with page 2 to page 100 that is not shown on page 1? Of course, it's a paradox. What, you know, how do I show what I don't show? I can't show the labels for everything. My screen is not big enough, and my perception is probably the bigger problem, that I can't, you know, attend to all of that. But what you can do is actually maybe give some notion of what is cut. But the larger problem actually that you're saying is, well, I only see the perspective around an anchor point. That's, I think that's your point, right? Like, I select an author, I see the world around the author, but the database actually has over a million papers and even more so metadata fields.
Yeah, it's like drop somebody with a helicopter to stay within the city metaphor. You drop somebody with a helicopter somewhere in Paris, and then let him walk around like for 10 minutes. And then you ask him, so what's the city like?
Yeah,
but yeah, what's the problem? I mean, if you are designing for an information flaneur, this is what you expect, right? I mean, I'm just trying to...
No, let's go along with this, because this is actually great. Great that you use Paris, Maurice.
Go ahead.
Do you think... So, first of all, I was going to say, well, there is no overview. But that sounds a little bit too philosophical. Mm-hmm. But do you think a truthful or useful representation of Paris if you hover over it, you know, a couple thousand meters?
You just see the streets. You don't see what's happening inside the store.
Yeah. You haven't spent time in a coffee shop. You haven't strolled along the Seine. Yeah. You haven't seen Mona Lisa, of course.
Yeah. Haven't been cheated by a taxi driver.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's what it takes to be in Paris, and you haven't had that. So, of course, there's a certain randomness if you just drop, you know, parachute it into a random street. So, I think that's still an open question when you deal with these large information spaces. What's your starting point? And that can be curated. Maybe you have, you know, maybe the researcher of the day, or it could be based on where you're from, what your home institution is. And with institution, I mean academic institution, or whatever, or, you know, where there's affinity with your research interests. So, for example, you could actually use a keyword like information visualization and then, you know, shape the visualization around that. So, but the thing is, and that that's what really excites me, is to question the overview.
Yeah. We just had Ben Schneiderman on the show, so we are now all pro overview. No, but I think you're absolutely. It's a really interesting thing to think about, and something that is probably not enough discussed. Like it seems to be like one of the basic assumptions in InfoWiz. In fact, that overview is super important, and I like how you question that. I think that's a
Well, it's really sort of like a. I haven't thought this through yet, so I'm sort of winging this. But I'm starting to wonder whether the visual information seeking mantra that Ben Schneiderman, who you had on the show last time, who I really admire and I love his work, and I find this, you know, this mantra also very useful. But this mantra says overview first, you know, and then zoom and filter, and then details on demand at some point.
Yeah.
But it prioritizes overview. And, you know, I think it's very useful because it actually sort of lists very important activities that we need to do with data and with information. And I think it's fine, but I think this prioritization is not what's always useful. I think sometimes it's nice to start maybe at a point that relates to you. Maybe you actually want to start local.
Mm.
So there was a
your hometown or something like this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe with yourself, you know, there's so much ego searching. So if you're an academic,
right,
you know, you might just look up yourself and then, you know, move along co-authors or your interests.
Explore and, that niche. That niche exploration. There's another point maybe for some data sets, it just works better to do overview type visualizations. I mean, my first thought would be the ones where you can actually nicely aggregate across along a hierarchy, like numbers, right? Then, of course, it's very easy to do like really seamless and nice overview things. But if you have like 10,000 photos or paintings, it's very hard to combine them in a meaningful way, right?
Some people try it, right? Like Lev Manovich, he's working with his colleagues at I think he was first in California, but now I think he's in New York.
New York, yeah.
He's doing the cultural analytics stuff, you know, placing thousands of Instagram photos on a plane and looking at the color patterns or, you know, Time magazine covers and so forth. And yes, we can see patterns. I think it's beautiful stuff. I would probably to some degree question the depth maybe of what we can see there, of the sort of color distributions. But I think when we ask for the overview, of, for example, publications of these more rich, not just quantitative, not just, you know, number series, but actually rich data sets, rich information spaces where we have titles, descriptions, maybe images, linkages and so forth. What would it mean to actually give an overview? What would it mean to show everything? And it means you're cutting away a lot of things. And then the question is, where do you cut? And I think, I worked on a project over the last year in Newcastle, where we were trying to sort of rethink the relationship between overview and detail, the individual element and the large collection, and I think that we have to sort of especially for these sort of rich information spaces, I think there's space to innovate in the space between abstract overviews and these sort of individual views of just one resource.
Sure, do you see these techniques also moving into, I mean, we do have a lot of browsing softwares and devices and so on already, actually don't use much data visualization, right? So our web browsers are still very, I mean, they have a back button, right? the way we interact on mobile with contents. Do you see, let's say, InfoVis techniques moving into that field? Or do you think this will be more specific interfaces that you use more in a, let's say, dedicated setting?
That's a good question. So I think visualization still has the allure of high tech and complexity and future and so forth. But I think that there's potential to integrate visualization, magic fairy dust into conventional interfaces, like a search interface can actually benefit from some visualization components. There's a nice library catalog interface from UTS, which is, I think, the Technical Uni of Sydney. So the UTS library interface has a Dewey Decimal classification visualization that is quite minimalistic. It's just a tiny band that is above the result display, and it sort of visualizes how many books are in each Dewey category. And you don't have to use it, you can just ignore it. But if you enter a search term, such as architecture, it will actually shape it will stretch or shrink the corresponding categories. And so you see sort of maybe, oh, architecture is actually not just in, I don't know what the labels are for the different top categories, but it's maybe not just culture or architecture, but it's also computer science, because people are talking about, you know, system architectures and so forth. And if you're actually interested in computing architectures, you could then click on that category, and it would then also behave as a filtering mechanism. So you can use the visualization in a very sort of lightweight way to sort of dive into a subset of the catalog without having to actually specify this is the Dewey Decimal thing, or actually specify the code. So this is an example of where you have actually visualization being introduced to an existing search or sort of filtering interface without actually turning the whole interface into a visualization, right? Just sort of, you know, have it a little, just a little bit in there integrated it. Yeah. And
that's interesting. Are you familiar with that notion of information sent?
Yeah, so information sent is quite related. It was sort of this idea that when we have a user interface and there are different options of navigating or of using filters, that they can be sort of shaped by color or by size that could be visualizing maybe a prior activity. Maybe more people have taken that path or have added more comments to that resource. So it's essentially, it's a way of, how do you say, yeah, informing your path by, for example, the activity of others mm-hmm. before, mm-hmm. but I think you can also use other data sources for it. That's a good question. I think information sent is slightly different because it uses some external source, I think, if I understand it correctly, mm-hmm. such as social activity, and blends it with your typical interface. Yeah. So it actually doesn't change your GUI or your interface or your result list or whatever, mm-hmm. but it sort of sprinkles some visualization
some data
happiness
on top.
To it. Yeah.
But I think there is a strong connection when you think about... So if we go back to the example that we were discussing before where you said, where if I start from a seed point, then I cannot visualize everything, right? I can basically only visualize the neighborhood of my seed point. And then you have a whole collection of things that you just cannot put in your visualization because it's too far away, right? But then information sent is a sort of framework that can help you deciding what to put in your context according to what is the... how to give the right information about what directions can be followed to get more information starting from the point where you are now. So there are lots of interesting research and tools and results out there that actually leverage on this idea. How do I visualize what is not in the direct neighborhood of my current point of view? And I think that's really, really, really interesting. And in the end, connected to what you said before looks quite relevant.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, we don't want to be just locked into our local view. I think that's what you're sort of referring to. So it's not just your immediate neighborhood in a graph or in an interface. And I mean, in a way, this asks a related question, which I think is also important. And it relates also to information sent. Do we is there a danger of just seeing the same? So that if we only show the stuff that is similar or that is directly yeah. related, are we just going in circles around the stuff that we are already interested in, knowledgeable about?
Filter bubble and so on.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and I haven't. That's something not even half baked. It's just raw. How can we express relationships of difference, of complementarity, of you know, the other corner of the data set that has something interesting to say about where you're at right now, but it's not similarity.
Right. Well, it could be interesting to think about if a user actually engages for a longer time, how can we make sure he sees a relevant portion of the whole thing? You know, so he has seen, you know, talking about Paris again, maybe he teleported him sometimes into the different quarters just to mix it up a little.
Yeah,
and so he can still do this instance-based exploration, but we make sure he encounters enough different stuff and isn't always running in circles, more or less. Yeah,
I think there might be some backlash if the system is the smart agent that decides, oh, you really should go to this other corner of the city or of the data set because you haven't seen it yet. Okay. But I think what would be as well, or maybe alternatively useful, is letting searchers or viewers make these decisions. So actually deciding, oh, I know I'm circling myself here,
yeah.
but the interface gives me a way to navigate away from it.
Yeah. Go to the opposite content would be a nice button sometimes.
Yeah, and I don't know yet how to do that. I mean, the random button, you know,
yeah,
has been around
nice
in search and in Wikipedia,
yeah.
but it's not quite that. So We worked, so I could mention another project that sort of slightly relates to that. Also relates to that question to overview and the individual element. Are you up for it?
Absolutely. Sure. Go ahead.
Always.
Okay, so that's something I've done with two people in Newcastle Uni, Rob Comer and Martin Dade Robertson, and it's we call it monadic exploration, and it's this this notion of navigating similar to pivot paths between individual elements, but then actually still showing the whole collection around these elements. And we call it monadic mm-hmm. because it's inspired or informed by sort of a philosophical and sociological concept of the monads of it's something that Bruno Latour, a French sociologist, has been writing about over the last couple of years. And it essentially is a sort of alternative to the distinction between the micro and the macro. So instead of talking about the individual and society, he argues that society is really hard to grasp anyways, and the individual is too little to actually make sense yep. of. So why don't we take the individual, and you know, in sociology it would be a human, in maybe in our case it would be data points, resources. If we take the individual element as a position and as a vantage point on the whole world, and the whole world might be a collection of photos, or you know, maybe in sociological terms it might be society, mm-hmm. then we could now in terms of visualization, we could arrange the collection or the data set around that individual element in a way that still shows this is this element's perspective. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's very unique. It's how, you know, it relates strongly or weakly with other elements, but it doesn't show just the immediate neighbors or the immediate properties of that element, mm-hmm. but actually allows you to see beyond that. So on the sort of metaphorically speaking, on the horizon, you would still see the elements that this element is not so much related to. So you could, you know, then navigate sort of, so to speak, to the other side of the data set, you know, if you make that choice.
And how's the project called, or where is it?
So it's called Monadic Exploration, mm-hmm. and it's still in submission as a paper, but we have a demo online, so cool. you can play around with it.
Okay. Can you send us the link so we can add it on the blog post?
Yeah. Yes, and I have to say a few extra words, actually. So we worked with a book editor team to actually bring this demo out. So it's the team behind Beautiful Trouble, which is sort of a book on creative and, I have to say, peaceful forms of activism. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about the book is, besides the content, which is really exciting, I find, but besides the actual content of the different chapters, is that they're all interlinked. So when you browse through the paper book, you see on the margins all these different see also links. Mm-hmm. So as a visualizer, as a computer nerd, I see a network. And I want to, you know, bring it on a screen, and they actually have all their content online on their website. So when I contacted them, they were actually quite open to working on that as a visualization project, and we sort of thought this through both sort of conceptually, but then eventually also in its sort of design ways. How do you arrange, you know, over 100 little modules in a way that encourages navigation, shows also something for each element, and you know how search plays into that, and it was really nice project actually. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
cool.
I just want to briefly mention one thing that came into my mind is that I truly believe that this idea of starting, so instead of following the overview first path, starting from one specific seed point, is not only interesting as a way to explore a data set, or might be interesting for exploration and serendipity. I also have practical examples where this kind of paradigm can be really, really useful because it matches much, much better the mental model that people have of the problem that they want to solve. So to give you a specific example, actually this comes from my own work. A few years back, I was working with a group of biologists, and so these people is interested in finding specific molecules that have certain behaviors, okay? And for months and months, we kept working on overviews of the old data set that they get out of these experiments that involve hundreds of thousands of molecules, okay? And every time we showed our results to them, the reaction was always kind of like, yeah, that's interesting, but. And there was always a but at the end, right? And I had a very hard time because we tried kind of like three or four different kind of completely different visual designs, right? And then one day I started speaking with this guy, a biochemist, and all in a sudden I realized, man, these people are really much interested. They're not interested at all in the overview. They don't want to detect patterns. They want to see what happens around some specific molecules they're interested in, right? So the way they think about the problem is what happens around this molecule. So even if they have a thousand, a million, or whatever kind of molecules in the as an outcome from their experiment, they have an entry point. They think about, I want to see what happens around this set of molecules. Then around can mean 10, hundreds, thousand, and so on, right? But here you have a specific example of how even in practical terms and even in projects where the focus is pretty much on problem solving, the way they think about the problem might actually lead to a design that starts from a specific seed point. And mm-hmm. I think this can apply to many other cases. So I have the feeling that there are cases where the way a person thinks about the problem matches very, very well with the idea of starting from one seed point or a few mm-hmm. seed points. And I mm-hmm. think this is somewhat unexplored.
There has been a paper on that, and I don't recall the exact author list, but I think Frank Van Ham was one author, and I think also Adam Perra. It's Search First and Expand Later or something
it's
like this.
It's called Search, so they were talking about Show Context, Expand on Demand.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So it's another mantra type thing.
It's another, yeah.
You scientists are in this mantra thing? I mean.
No, but they are basically advocating for the same kind of thing. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's cool.
We are quite esoteric people, don't you know?
Yeah. I realized very late, but then I realized hard.
What I find fascinating about that, you know, Enrico, you working with biologists and sort of developing, oh, wow, there are actually certain problems that require a different perspective. And I am noticing this more and more that actually, in my case, sort of particular collections or information spaces, maybe archives, that engaging with the people who maintain this data set or, you know, these resources is actually can be really fruitful. Because when I want to sort of support this notion of the information flaneur, I don't want a neutral sort of clinical version of the data. I think what is useful and what is sort of also inviting is a representation, an interface that, respects the ethos and the aesthetics of a collection. Maybe that's not what the biologists are after, but actually developing a sensibility for the data and also for the context and for the aura or for, you know, the spirit.
Right.
And going back to the esoteric stuff, right? Actually, sort of the softer aspects that might not play to what we think or what we have thought what visualization is about, but I think we should also keep that in mind. And we actually worked with a photo archive in Newcastle, and you know, sort of ethical and ethical questions, and also the questions of how photos would be shown in which kind of context were key, because these photos were documenting people's lives, and you know, you can't just mesh it up randomly. Like there's there are stories, there's fabric that you can't just
tear also
apart.
If let's say you have just numbers and somebody's just interested in finding a number or summing up numbers, then the number is sort of the end point. But if you visualize, let's say, an art collection, the things you're visualizing is just an indexical, like a pointer to the actual thing, which is like this super deep work and has this huge historical context and has the artist and behind it and so on. And so I absolutely agree. That's a whole different story. And you can't mash them up like arbitrarily or just do the average of two artworks and see what you end up with. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can play around with it, and there have been some nice attempts doing this, but I think you lose a lot of integrity, and I think there's I find it quite fruitful to actually hear. Well, also to be pointed out what the interesting linkages are. Mm-hmm. Sure, we can link the crap out of the data sets that we have, but what are actually the meaningful and the maybe the links that are not shown in typical interfaces?
Yeah,
and I think working with domain experts and the people that actually use these data sets and these collections in their own work is super beneficial. Yeah. And then I think can also give rise to new representations, new visualizations. Yeah.
So yeah, let's just assume I just registered like monadflaneur.com and I want to start my own thing there. I mean, no, more seriously, do you have any tips or from your experiences, is like if you want to optimize for that precise thing, like the serendipity and the information send and the flaneurism, are there any like design patterns or things where you thought these things would be easy but then turned out hard, or any mechanisms which you find interesting, something where people can get started in designing interfaces for flaneurs?
Yeah, that's exactly the same kind of question that I wanted to ask Marian.
Very
because
good.
Even from the academic point of view, I'm just trying to think how do you, so as soon as you move out of this problem solving kind of framework, how do you actually guide yourself into the design process? When do you know that you have designed the right quote thing, right?
Ooh, okay,
sorry, we are torturing you today.
People.
We are grilling Marianne.
So first of all, if you have the information flaneur on your side, or you identify with him and her, I think that's already useful to actually. That's just the benefit of personas, and personas have been around in design thinking for years, maybe ages. I don't know, but that can be useful to have a concrete person with certain abilities and characteristics and so forth. Now, to actually move this forward into your design process, I found the notion of explorability very useful. So to me, this is like a complementary principle besides usability. While usability speaks to the sort of interface mechanisms, are the buttons, do they have the right size, mm-hmm. Is the text legible, and so forth. It's sort of, usability, in my eyes, describes a relationship between interface and hardware and, artifacts, and the user or the viewer and so forth. Mm-hmm. And for me, explorability, in a way, says, there can be hardware, software, visualizations, blah, blah, blah. These are sort of the mediating things. But let's talk about the relationship between the content or the information space or the data and the searcher or the viewer, mm-hmm. right? So human and information, maybe. And I think explorability is useful because it speaks to, we really want to have this flaneur engage with the data, move around. And under that sort of umbrella term, explorability, how can we make information spaces explorable? I found sort of three guiding concepts useful. First, orientation. So think about how your interface shows you where you are in an information space and also where you can go. Mm-hmm. So make invitations for your next navigation steps, and also vice versa. Give a way to provide mechanisms to trace back your to go back to where you started. Mm-hmm. So the obvious sort of function in a browser is, of course, the back button or the browser's history, something that actually is still not very often supported in visualizations, so that you can actually have sort of like an implicit Well, not bookmarks. We can also use it for bookmarks, but an implicit sort of history of the navigation steps that we have in the visualization. So that's sort of orientation, both where we have been and also where we can go. And then there's this principle of visual momentum. It's sort of this notion of perceptual continuity that describes that when we have two subsequent display states, how much overlap is between them. Mm-hmm. So when I move from one search result page to the next because I added a new query term, maybe there's actually overlap between the results. And visual momentum, if there's a high level of visual momentum, I can actually make the connection because maybe a result item moves a few steps up and is actually animated to that state. But this actually, in our, you know, in today's search interfaces, visual momentum is very low because we have abrupt changes. So if you want to support that sort of more continuous experience through an information space, think about how the subsequent display states are intertwined and sort of connected mm-hmm. through transitions and animations and so forth. Don't overdo it. You know, it doesn't always make sense. It might be quite distracting to use, you know, rotating whatever crazy animations. But where it makes sense, where actually the same elements are between two display states, try to, you know, create some continuity so that your perceptual apparatus is not always asked, oh, where am I? Where am I? Where's the element from the last display state and so forth? And the third sort of concept is, I find, quite hard to design for, serendipity. But I think it's important as designers of these sort of visualizations and information interfaces is to think about how we make invitations to discover things that we didn't look for and actually and pursue these sort of information encounters. And we talked about this already quite a bit, but essentially, show things that are related for maybe strange reasons or for unexpected reasons. And
yeah, but it's something more that emerges probably if you do all the rest right, right? Or, I mean, it's difficult to start with saying like, oh, we want to optimize for serendipity or, yeah.
It's hard, but well, so if you're dealing with photo collections, you know, for example, and look at the relationships between photos or between sets, I think it can be useful to ask yourself as a designer, what would it mean to make a serendipitous encounter? You know, going from, if you're just moving within sets and if it's just your hierarchical, typical, you know, album, whatever, or set situation, maybe there's almost no opportunity for these encounters. And how can you expose some other linkages that are maybe something that you didn't look for or wouldn't look for otherwise.
Yeah, super interesting. So do you think there will be like a Flaneur designer's handbook out at some point?
I don't see myself as a book author, but I think, I mean, there are some visualization in search, you know, has been a topic for quite some time.
Yeah.
So I think we will see more of it, and I think it will start with maybe smaller visualizations integrated in search, and maybe these larger visualizations integrating more and more search capability. And I can keep you posted.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I absolutely agree. There's so much potential for visualization in the cultural sphere that we don't really. Or just a few people who are just interested, you know, they make use of that and do really exciting stuff. But I think there's gonna much more to come, both on a like institutional level, like visualizing collections of museums or things like that, but also your personal stuff, like your music library, your photos, your texts. I think that's super exciting. Any other projects we should check out? Are there any like really, really amazing projects in that area?
I was actually, now that you just mentioned collections, I'm not sure if we talked before the show or during the show about generous interfaces and Mitchell Whitelaw's work.
No,
at
we
the
haven't.
University of Canberra.
Yeah.
Okay, so I found his notion of generosity in terms of interfaces very useful.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being stingy and only showing you something after you entered a search query, a generous collection interface actually shows you already samples of the resources, of the paintings, of the photos, whatever, and blending this with visualization power. So actually showing maybe the distribution of resources over time mm-hmm. or among different techniques and so forth. So I think that's very useful. I mean, there's lots of activity in this space. You just mentioned cultural collections. The digital humanities have been for the last few years becoming really interested in visualization.
Yeah.
In collections, lots of things are moving right now. So I can send you some links when some things come to mind.
Sure. Yeah. Great. Fascinating topic. Yeah. I'm all for building browsing interfaces.
I feel like
now.
We just started scratching the surface.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, even just thinking about visualization integrated with search looks like there's not much of, I cannot think of too many examples where visualization and search are very well tied together, coupled. And
there were a lot like 15 years ago, yeah, 10 to 15 yeah, exactly. years, you know, yeah, there was yeah, a lot of research in that area, absolutely. But then sort of, yeah, the focus has shifted a bit.
Yeah.
And I think they were all very much tied to this old notion of search that you enter a search query and you quickly grasp what is the most relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think now there are some thinking about more, you know, exploratory search, slow search, mm-hmm. More open-ended types of information seeking. And I think this is really where visualization can shine to show relationships that you wouldn't need if you just look for a book quickly, but that you might be interested in when you want to sort of search through as opposed to search quickly.
Right. Yeah, or for a collection, just understand what's there and not what's there in sums, but what's there in things and actual things that you can inspect and quickly understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Super interesting. Cool. Good stuff. I think we have to wrap it up. Time's almost up.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah. We should chat more at some point. Maybe maybe we will at some point actually manage to get Moritz out to a visualization conference.
Paris.
Only serendipitously. No, Paris is like it's difficult.
Come on.
So if far Paris away. I think I'll make it to Paris in one way or the other. I mean.
You have to.
I might stage a little counter conference, for instance.
I think you should take a helicopter and
shoot myself randomly into the city and start walking.
Yeah, exactly. With a couple
That's
of bodyguards.
The spirit. Anything else would be too analytic. Excellent.
Okay, guys.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, Marian.
Thanks so much.
Thank you guys for having me. It has been a pleasure also listening to you guys for the last 29 episodes. Yeah. So keep it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.